Our first guest in this book fair show is Leslie Kern. She's a geographer from Canada. She's working a lot with urban geography, social and feminist movements, and teaching at the Mount Allison University in Canada. And we're very happy to have you here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And yeah, maybe we could start to talk about your new book. The German title is Gentrifizierung lässt sich nicht aufhalten und andere Lügen, so it's about gentrification. And maybe we can start to talk about an accurate description, maybe. So, I mean, gentrification is on everybody's lips, everyone is talking about. We know it has something to do with changing cities, changing the people living there. Living is getting more and more expensive. Some people are displaced, maybe other people come. But could you maybe describe for a moment what gentrification actually means?
For me, I think of gentrification as being about power, and specifically about the power to take and remake space, either in your own image, to suit your identity and lifestyle, or perhaps simply to be able to extract a profit from that space. So it's a process of taking over, usually an urban neighborhood, these days sometimes whole areas of cities, and completely transforming the social and economic character of those places.
Your book that has been translated to German recently dispels myths about gentrification, and the title suggests that there are quite a few where gentrification is inevitable and other lies. So what are these other lies and who is telling them?
Yes, I think the first one that I would actually call a lie is the idea that gentrification is natural, that it happens kind of organically in cities, and that it's almost an evolutionary process where neighborhoods go from working class or racial minority to being wealthier, whiter, fancier, more upscale. And the problem with this myth is that it allows us to ignore all of the very real decisions that are made by cities and different actors in cities to make gentrification possible. It's as though it just happens out of thin air rather than because people make policies and plans to promote it. The other myths in the book or lies are a little more nuanced. It's not that they are outright lies per se, but they are stories, ways of understanding gentrification that I argue could use some more nuance, or that we could expand to take us beyond the kind of mainstream, well-rehearsed, maybe simplified explanations of gentrification.
Let's go a bit back in time. Gentrification's process has been described since the late 50s or maybe 60s, when the first scientists worked on the change of cities. And now you've written the book, it's like 70 years after that. Can there still be something new written about gentrification?
Well, of course, I think so, because I wrote a book about it. But one of the reasons and one of the things that actually makes gentrification so difficult to fight against is that it keeps taking new forms and being pushed forward by different groups of actors or powerful people and organizations. So when it was first described and named in 1964 by a sociologist named Ruth Glass, who was looking at neighborhoods in London and the way that they were changing from working class areas to just kind of on the cusp of middle class areas. And it was a very gradual process. People would move in, they would renovate a house, oh, somebody else would move in. But over time, it enacted this complete transformation. But yes, 70 years later, what's new? Well, we might still see that form of gentrification in some neighborhoods, but you're much more likely to see developers building dozens of luxury high-rise apartment building complexes, or cities demolishing social housing to make way for private market housing. Or even if you go on TikTok, you can find influencers posting videos about how to, you know, make your first million in the real estate market, or how to evict tenants so you can raise the rent, and all sorts of kind of pernicious things. So there always seems to be a new story about gentrification to tell.
What was interesting for me is that you argue in your book that gentrification is a kind of a continuation of the settler colonial project that removed natives from their land. What makes you apply colonial power structures to gentrification processes?
Yes, well, in countries like Canada, where I'm from, we consider them settler colonial nations because the colonizers never left, right? We are still under a form, at least, of British control and a legacy of French colonialism as well. And just like gentrification, colonialism is a process of taking over space, taking land, turning it into private property, and capitalizing on it. Capitalism and colonialism were kind of born at the same time out of the same things. And so, okay, again, if we're fast forwarding in time, you might think, well, what does that have to do with, you know, the 21st century? Well, gentrification is a way of kind of consolidating the power of private property ownership in cities, which is a further barrier to movements by indigenous people to regain some control over their traditional territories, to have more sovereignty. And this is not just a kind of a remote rural area issue. About 50% of indigenous people in Canada live in cities, and they are often some of the most marginalized and excluded people in cities, and gentrification is making their lives worse. So I think of it as a ongoing part of colonialism.
Maybe you can stay on diving even deeper into your book. The chapters of your book show also new perspectives on gentrification. The focus is on urban space, though not only. You're also talking about gentrification as a metaphor that can be also applied in other spheres. How could it be applied, for example, in cultural spheres?
Yes, well, gentrification is often used as a metaphor to describe when an ordinary object, for example, or a food or a kind of style, aesthetic, suddenly becomes upscaled in some way. So it might become more expensive, it might become more exclusive in some manner. And so people will kind of informally say, this food is now gentrified, or this style of music is now gentrified, or things like tattoos, for example, some people have argued are gentrified. I mean, tattoos, you know, in our parents' generation were seen as something very rebellious, very working class, maybe associated with prisons and gangsters and motorcycle gangs. And now everybody has a tattoo, and they're very expensive to get, and they're very, you know, a sign of a certain kind of cultural standing. So we can now see the ways in which the concept of gentrification can be useful for understanding how certain cultural moments or objects become sometimes appropriated by other cultures, and some of their meaning is stripped away to make them kind of consumer objects, if you will, for other people.
I think it's really interesting to think about gentrification as a metaphor, but I'm wondering, doesn't the concept of gentrification maybe lose a little bit of its analytical strength as a concept that really is down to cities?
That is certainly a danger, and researchers of gentrification have been warning against that very danger since the 1980s, at least. So it has long been a concern that the concept would be applied to places and processes that were not really clearly gentrification. For me, I think there's still value in using the word itself. So the first part of the word gentry, referring to sort of the upper class, right? Gentle people or gentlemen. So there's still a class-centered perspective embedded in the term that I think is important, because if we switch to other language like renewal or revitalization, these are very depoliticized. They seem very neutral, and they take away that notion that there is a power struggle that's part of gentrification. So I think for now we should keep using it, even though in some cases it may have been stretched a little beyond its original meaning.
Yeah, maybe we could talk about how gentrification applies to different cities. We said before that gentrification was first observed in the late 1950s, now it's spread all over the world, everyone is talking about it. How did it came to this point that gentrification now is a phenomenon that is not only can be applied to big cities like San Francisco or London, but to nearly all bigger cities?
Yes, it certainly has spread and become a global phenomenon. And in some cases, I think that's because certain kinds of policy agendas that cities take on can become sort of popularized and they spread. There's, I think it's called like policy mobility is the sort of theory that explains that. But it's essentially where one city or state or nation kind of picks up on what others are doing. And it, you know, can then just travel and travel and travel and kind of mutate to suit its local surroundings. And so today we have all of these, you know, new or newish forms of gentrification that kind of take their cue from whatever is happening in the local environment. So in San Francisco, for example, with the tech boom in the surrounding areas of San Francisco, the gentrification there seems to be very fueled by those large tech companies like Google, with all of their employees coming into the city and wanting to buy property there. And many of the working class Latino and Black neighborhoods in San Francisco are feeling a lot of upward pressure on housing prices and rents. And people have even said that, you know, sort of ordinary middle class working people like teachers, firefighters, they can't afford to live in the city anymore. They have to, you know, commute in from long distances just to go to work in a school, for example.
The first thing you mentioned, that there are often policies like wandering around the globe from city to city. I think we'll keep that in mind for later, talking about what there is to do against gentrification. But let's stay a little bit longer with different examples. You already mentioned San Francisco, and in your book, you look at different cities, for example, London, Toronto, and San Francisco. And I'm interested in how does gentrification differ around the world in different cities? It's certainly a similar process, but it has a different appearance in cities around the world.
Absolutely. I think one of the main areas to look for differences would be the extent to which the state, local governments, and city governments are involved in the process. So, and this can look very different. It might be a lot of state intervention. So, for example, converting public housing or social housing, as I mentioned before, into market rate housing to, you know, be able to capitalize on an area of the city that was previously, if it was social housing, it wasn't really making money for anybody, right? So you got to change that. In other cases, it might look like the government deregulating things, so taking away protections from tenants in renters-related legislation, making it easier for developers to, you know, propose like luxury high-rise apartment buildings, to rezone areas of the city to make it possible for this sort of development to happen, declaring certain districts to be, you know, new development districts. So there's a range of ways in which governments might be involved and have kind of greater or lesser control. And a lot of that depends on the kind of political norms of a particular country that we're looking at. And so that's one reason why we can see kind of different flavors, if you will, of gentrification in cities around the world.
And maybe gentrification is mostly focusing on cities or on big cities, let's say. You're at the moment no longer living in such a big city. Or are there still gentrification processes maybe in smaller cities or countryside or comparable?
Yes, so some people have certainly argued that we should be able to apply the term gentrification to rural areas. And there are similarities. And yes, I live in a very small town on the east coast of Canada, in one of the poorer provinces of the country. And interestingly, during the pandemic, when many people began to work remotely and wanted to move out of big cities for various reasons, they started appearing in the area where I live, which is quite rare. Nobody really moves in there. And all of a sudden, housing prices went up. I live in a university town, so many students live there and need to rent homes. And all of a sudden, they found they couldn't afford places to live anymore. There was very little availability because the owners could rent them out or sell their homes to people who were coming from bigger cities like Toronto or Vancouver. So in that sense, we are seeing a kind of takeover of that space by wealthier, more powerful individuals. So I think it's reasonable to talk about gentrification in that context, even though, yes, it's kind of been moved out of its urban origins.
So we've talked about gentrification, about your definition, how to analyze it, what effects it has. And in a way, it's unbelievable that gentrification is happening since nearly 70 years all over the world, and it seems like nothing can stop this process. Why is it so difficult to oppose gentrification?
That's a great question. One of the reasons goes back to that myth that I was speaking about earlier, the idea that it's somehow just natural, something that we have to expect and accept in cities. That, I think, has done a lot of damage to people's willingness and ability to argue against gentrification, especially among politicians and people who have the ability to do something about it. But beyond that, why is it so difficult to stop? Well, I mean, it's a process that benefits the most powerful and wealthy, you know, not just individuals, but corporations, investors, and so on. And there's not really a lot of will amongst the political class to stand up against it. So that kind of leaves things to community organizations, activist movements, ordinary people. And I think, as we all know, it's very difficult for us to go up against those powers that be. So we have to kind of look for small victories wherever they may happen, even if it doesn't mean completely stopping or reversing gentrification, but maybe just being able to pause it or slow it down a little.
Yeah, and I mean, we really want to know how to oppose it. That's why we're talking now. You're also addressing this question in the book, of course, how to oppose gentrification. And you're also speaking that directly to the reader and ask them to deal or to ask themselves or oneself about their own role in the process of gentrification. For me, this was a really interesting and good point to think about how I'm myself as well as part of in this process. But maybe if some of our listeners now want to get or start an engagement against gentrification, what would you say? What would be a good point to start?
Sure. I tend to think that in any neighborhood that's experiencing gentrification or problems associated with it, like poverty, rising rents, food insecurity, and so on, there are probably already organizations in the community doing work on those issues. So if you want to get involved, look for what is already being done rather than think that you have to start something new yourself. And that could mean volunteering your time. It could mean sending a little money to those organizations or using your knowledge and skills to help the cause. You can also just think about on a day-to-day basis, how are you behaving in your neighborhood? Are you interacting with your neighbors, especially the kind of older, longtime community members? Are you going to the older businesses in the community? Are you looking out for people who may be unhoused or experiencing mental health issues or disability in the community? So just thinking about how to be a good neighbor to the people who are already there and not be engaged in the kind of politics that tries to push those people out. So not being a NIMBY, as we say, which stands for not in my backyard in English. So starting from where you are, thinking about what influence you have, thinking about what's already going on in the communities where you live and how you might be a part of that, and recognizing that many movements are interconnected. So if you're doing anti-violence work, if you're involved in climate change activism, you know, you're already contributing because all of these problems are related to one another.